Every time I see a mission statement, I've learned to ask 5 questions. 1, does it have both ends and means in it? Many mission statements are only vision statements, dealing with ends. Many mission statements are only value statements, dealing with means. Ends and means are inseparable. You'll never really accomplish a worthy end with an unworthy means. 2, do the mission statement deal with all stakeholders? Not just, obviously, the customers and the employees and the owners, but also the suppliers, also the community, because many are reaping where they have not sown and must give back. And if we don't have more social and business commitment to our environment and to the next generation through education, we'll find that the social problems may eventually overwhelm the economic machinery and discombobulate all society. 3, does the mission statement deal with all 4 needs? The economic, the social, how people are treated and so forth, the psychological, how people are developed and used, and the spiritual, the meaning that people get from their work, the sense of contribution, the sense of making a difference, and also the sense of integrity, that there's an effort to have an integrated culture based on principles, based on the mission statement. 4, does the mission statement come from the bowels of the organization? Is it deeply bought into? Is it understood? Do people emotionally identify with it? Perhaps many were involved in developing it. Were they trained in it? Were they socialized into it? And 5, is it used as a constitution? Is it the supreme law of the land? Interestingly, number 9 item said, whoever receives a guest complaint owns the complaint. Another item said, never point, always escort. Another item had to do with personalizing, calling the person by name. In fact, I said to one of them, does this affect how you live at home? And this one person said to me, absolutely. Never before at my home have I said, it's my pleasure, and other kind words of that nature. I'm absolutely convinced that you can help people personally by working at the social level as well as at the personal level. If you create the third domain, the culture, in their business, what a magnificent challenge and meaning that gives to a manager or a leader who has that sense of stewardship and knows also that it contributes tremendously to quality and eventually to the bottom line because of the development of a culture that is founded upon principles and not upon quick fix cosmetics. You know, those series of mission statements that were in alignment to each other also taught me the essence of what empowerment really is. Commissioning. When you overlap the 4 needs of individuals with the 4 needs of organizations, you've essentially got an empowerment condition. Co-missioning, commingling missions. But that is not an easy process at all. Eventually, it comes down to the individual job, so that every job, in a sense, has what I like to call a win-win performance agreement. That means a mission statement at the job level. It can be between individuals, it can be between an individual and a department, or between 2 departments, or between the entire organization with all of its stakeholders. But that process of commingling missions, getting deep involvement, helps to create this whole internal sense of motivation and excitement, and creates this third domain where the law of the unenforceable operates. I saw a perfect example of this in another hotel situation where the manager told me, for the first time, I've come to understand what empowerment meant. He said, I always thought that meant proper delegation at the top levels. He said, but over half of our workforce are housekeepers, and I've now learned that those too can be empowered. They gradually built an emotional bank account with those housekeepers by involving them, by tapping into these 4 needs, the economic need to be treated fairly, the social need to be treated kindly, the psychological or mental need to have their talents developed and utilized, and the spiritual need to have a sense of meaning and a sense of integrity. And I said, what have you done? He said, we've involved them. These housekeepers make all decisions involving their own work scheduling, involving the materials they use, and eventually we've reached the point of such trust, we have told them we will not sell any rooms until you give your stamp of approval. Just try to imagine this scene. Guests trying to get into rooms but can't because the housekeepers won't release the rooms. Management people running to the housekeepers and saying, why won't you release the rooms? Because the rooms aren't ready, that's why. What do you mean they're not ready? You know the criteria we agreed upon. We all participated in this. And these rooms don't meet those criteria. In what way? Look at that carpeting. Look at that drapery. Look how that toilet works. Look at that television. We've had these work orders in for days, and nothing's being done about them, and we're not going to release these rooms for sale until these jobs get done. It started to drive quality through that whole operation in almost unbelievable ways. This manager said, you know what else? There is no supervision. None. None. N-O-N-E. Three entire levels of supervision were done away with. Why? The third domain got so large. The law of the unenforceable. Can you imagine in that kind of culture going in with the old sandwich technique of performance appraisal, saying a few nice words, slipping in the knife, twisting it a couple of times, and a few nice words at the bottom? Who does the performance appraisal? They have praised themselves. Where do we get the concept that one person judges another? When trust is high, what is your experience? Are people easier or tougher on themselves? Always tougher. Why? Because they have so much more knowledge. Trust is high. They have problems. They need help. They see you as a source of help. Why? Because trust is high. Because you have a strong immune system. You have a powerful culture. A great sociologist, Durkheim, put it this way. It's a brilliant statement. And you think about it, how relevant it really is. He said, when mores are sufficient, laws are unnecessary. When mores are insufficient, laws are unenforceable. Now, to use the hotel situation, when mores, a more is a norm, it's the expected social way of behaving. When mores are sufficient, that is, are we really about customer service, really? Or do we just give it as our PR thing, our cosmetic advertising, see? When mores are sufficient, laws, roadmaps are unnecessary. When you get enough people committed to central purposes and principles, you don't need extensive policy and procedure manuals. If you do not have that commitment, though, you're going to find some need of something that is predictable for people because they are dependent, see? They're not capable of operating on their own hook, on their own initiative. And whatever you come up with, you've got to be constantly changing it, which disturbs people. You have to change it because the environment's changing so rapidly. Then it upsets people. Then they resist change. Then they try to come up with some new philosophy or practice that can handle that. And there are scores of different management philosophies that have come out. Participative management, MBO, management by results, 9-9. So many different systems and philosophies with all their own unique language, which gives them a kind of market positioning, even though a lot of them are teaching the same basic principles. But the underlying strength of anything that comes out are those principles. But if they do not teach underlying principles, and if they do not get a deep buy-in, see, to where these are the mores, the norms of the organization, it will not happen. When mores are sufficient, strong, into the atmosphere, then roadmaps, see, laws are unnecessary. When mores are insufficient, they're not adequate, then you need, but then they're not enforceable because the mores won't sustain them. So the wrong is in getting caught. When my boss is around,
I might do it, see? When his boss is around, he's on his best behavior. Whatever. See, so that what really happens is you condition people to develop a political mind, a kind of political conscience. The wrong is in getting caught. Not in doing wrong. Total quality must begin with total personal quality. Otherwise, if the head's polluted, what's the water going to be like downstream? Those are very profound experiences. And by the way, I wanted to emphasize again, I'm just talking about one illustration. You know, my hotel experiences, we could come up and you could come up with many, many, not just on customer service, but how to get innovation, how to deal with ethical issues, how to get a higher degree of, say, participation and better ideas that come from involving other people, how to build teams between warring units, see. You could take any subject, study, and you would find good illustrations and bad illustrations. So I just focused upon customer service because, in a sense, that's my day-to-day experience so much, and I'm very sensitive to it. But please remember, it is the principle we're teaching, not these practices. Those only illustrate the principle. In fact, think about it with regard to the hotel experiences, because all four levels were involved. Personal, the personal level. That is, there was an individual that I was talking to, and I was an individual. We are people, the personal level. Second, the interpersonal level. That is, my relationship with another person. See, perhaps she is the guest. Perhaps she is my boss. Perhaps she is my neighbor. That's an interpersonal relationship. You'll notice in those illustrations, it always involved human relations. We'll call that the interpersonal dimension. Next, the managerial. Say that she is my boss, and we also happen to be neighbors and friends in a common social setting, but there is a sense of responsibility that I have, which I have been assigned, and she is my so-called boss, my so-called supervisor. Now, this is the managerial level, as distinguished from just a relationship between people. The setting up of our arrangement and how we continue to work in that arrangement and improve it and produce on it and so forth, that's managerial. With me? Next level is the organizational level. So, the managerial level, she would like to, say, help me become more skilled in a particular area so she can draw upon a training department who can supply some of that. Or she can ask other people to give me some on-the-job training. There's a little difficulty over here with people's compensation situation. So someone has to kind of study that compensation, make sure that it is truly fair. So that's the compensation system. We have problems. There's problems between her department and another department. How do they solve problems? How do they communicate to solve problems? Well, there's some kind of chain of command. There's some line of authority. It may be a matrix organization, you know, where a person has more than one boss. But they have their systems and their structure to facilitate how you solve problems. Now, this is very elementary, very kindergarten-ish, but the main point is there are four levels. This is an ecosystem. What does ecosystem mean to you, my friends? Anyone?
Balanced, interdependent.
Okay, balanced, a whole, interdependent. What was your comment?
Interdependent balance system.
Yeah, interdependent balance system. Everything relates to everything else. Now what we're doing, we're starting to develop a paradigm that is holistic, that is an ecosystem, ecologically related. Now, I'm going to try to demonstrate that if you work at one of those levels, it is insufficient. If you work at two or three of the levels, it is insufficient. The key is you must work at all four. And that it's the synergy in the ecosystem that gives it its life, its spirit, its culture, its character. That is, in a sense, my bottom line answer. Now, I know I didn't give any specifics on these four, which we'll go into. I'm just trying to establish very early now that any organization is like an ecological environment, including a family. It is a social setting with many forces that are operating. So get into your head the paradigm. That's the map. That's the way you see the territory, see? That organizational life, including family life, is an ecosystem that is governed on natural laws. That's why we talk about principles, see? Not governed by social laws. For instance, to go back to my earlier illustration with the school and the farm, would you say that family life is more like the school or more like the farm? On the farm. Even though it is a social relationship there, you can't cram and rebuild relationships. You can't get too efficient-minded. See, efficiency is a value that is not applicable to natural systems. It takes patience. You cannot violate natural processes. You must prepare the ground before you plant. Then water and nurture and weed and cultivate. And give time before the grass will germinate or whatever you're bringing about, see, before the fruits can come. So also, in any relationship, get into your head, you're not dealing with things. Efficiency is not the value. The value is to understand and follow the natural law, what we call principles, if we can identify what those are. And the conviction is that if you get enough involvement by enough people, that there is so much deep wisdom that people know what those principles are, that the vast majority know what those principles are, and they will agree. There will be no disagreement. And that has been my experience. Seriously, I very seldom have an exception to that experience. As long as you have enough people involved, it's like governing by the consent of the governed about the truly strategic issues, the things that create the framework, the context into which everything operates. And what are those? Purpose and principles. Now, what we need to do is go through each of those four levels and complete our paradigm. What's the first level?
Personal.
Personal. Why is that the first level? It is the building block.
You must have your own house in order.
You must have your own house in order. If you do not have the building block, you can't do anything else. Because all you're fundamentally working with in the last analysis are people. It's not strategies, programs, systems, structures. It's people that are the programmers to it all.
You want to build an organization on trust, you have to be trustworthy.
Okay, if you want to build trust, you have to be personally trustworthy. Now, what he's talking about is what level?
Interpersonal.
The interpersonal. And if the personal is the building block, what would trust be?
The glue.
The glue. The cement ties the building blocks together so that when the storms come, the environmental pressures, it just doesn't blow that thing away. But there is a cohesiveness to it. Then when you get into the other levels, like the managerial level, how would that apply to the house metaphor or illustration?
Take care of it, maintenance.
Okay. And what kind of purpose you want to use that house for? What is the purpose of this area? What kind of views do you want? Where do you do your washing? Where do you do the eating, sleeping, and so forth, see? And you're making managerial decisions. And that drives what? The organization of the house, structure, and the systems, like what? Plumbing, electrical. See what I mean? So the house metaphor is powerful in expressing all four levels. Let's now look at the first level, and this will get into your question. As we look at these needs, these four needs that we speak about, we're starting with the personal. I'm going to try to describe these four needs and then show the different management paradigms that come out of these needs. Okay? First, the economic need. What is the economic need? What's the basic need in life? To make a living. You might say it's just to survive, but in our complex interdependent society, what's the medium of exchange that enables survival?
Money.
So the economic need is to have sufficient money for our needs and our wants and for those in our stewardship, our family or others that we are interested in. But to just survive, isn't that the first and most basic need? It really is. Think about it. All right, now after you survive, take that newborn, what's the next need?
Emotion.
Right. You need some kind of nurturance. You need a relationship. It's not just food. You need love. You need a relationship. You need to feel that someone attends to you. Your dependency, that's the next need. And in an organization, that social need is expressed in the fact that you have relationships with others. What's the next need? Right. You want to grow and to develop. So the child goes to school. The child starts to learn from parents and friends. In the latent talent, the dormant capacities, the dormant intelligences start to become enlivened and activated, enlarged, and they begin to find satisfactions from the use of those talents. That's the next need. Now, if you frustrate the first need, what's going to happen to the second? People won't survive. If you frustrate the second need, what's going to happen to the third? They don't care that much. They want relationship. And if that need is frustrated, what do they do? If the social need and the psychological need, okay, they're surviving well, let's say. See, then they'll use that survival and that prosperity in many, many ways to get those other needs satisfied. If I can buy enough things, I might buy belonging, see? And then they become centered on possessions and centered on your acceptance of me. Are you with me? Okay, now those are three needs. Now there's another need. And that is what I would call a spiritual need. It's the need for meaning. The need that your life matters. To put these four needs very briefly, I say this. Our needs are to live, to love, to learn, and to leave a legacy. Four L's, acronym, to help us remember. To live, what need is that?
Economic.
Okay, the economic, the physical. To love, what need is that?
Social,
emotional. To learn, that is to grow, to develop. And to have that capacity used, that psychological, and the need for meaning, for some purpose. You want to see a need for meaning? Any of you ever had a tragedy happen in your family or among your dear friends where someone was perhaps killed in an accident or something, or they died from a disease that could have been properly handled in another way or something? Any of you ever had an experience like this? What happened to you after that waste took place? Okay, questions, anger. Okay, once you got through the process of anger and maybe guilt, I'm convinced the dominant emotion in funerals is guilt, not grief. I wish I had done, or I wished something like this. Well, anyway, as soon as you get through those processes, the personal processes, and you've had this horrible waste, what do you want then? Yeah, to make that thing have some meaning. Why was the Vietnam War so deeply disillusioning to this country? Because there was a common and gradual buy-in. It was meaningless. People have a need for purpose, see? That my life matters, that I can leave a legacy. We could call that the spiritual need. Now, those are the four needs.